The walls were decorated with wonderful sculptured designs and mural paintings out of consonance with the poor artistic ability displayed in other parts of the city. Passing through this hall into the center nave, I gasped in amazement, for under the great dome, whose loftiness extended almost beyond my vision, was a colossal statue of the deity whom we know as Poseidon, fashioned, heaven alone knows how, in solid gold. The figure was driving a chariot drawn by six horses over a sea of golden foam. How can I do justice to such a stupendous creation? I could not even conjecture how it came to be erected, nor the astronomical value of the metal. But it was so exquisitely fashioned that life and vitality seemed to radiate from it, the leaping horses, the boat-like chariot, the curling waves. But most of all the virility derived from that powerful figure, all seemed to melt into a message of power. I could well imagine that it formed a transforming station for divine power, slowed down to meet the lower vibrations of this mundane kingdom. Regretfully, we passed on to the further hall, only to experience the same sense of wonder. For here there was no decoration at all except for a golden sunburst in the roof. Below it was a low stone altar. The light was dimmed here and helped to create an atmosphere which met you at the entrance and enfolded you with a mysterious sense of something exquisitely beautiful and holy, not to be embodied in form. I felt nearer to God in this holy sanctuary than anywhere I have ever known. One felt holy here, touched by that divine stillness that is such a benediction to the soul. One could almost hear the words, "Come unto me." The loveliness of that moment was such that I could not estimate how long we stood there, in adoration of that which was within. But we could not stand there forever, and presently Zeros drew me to a side hall which was broken up into sanctuaries, libraries and living quarters. In the libraries were books, not very many, with pages of paper thin metal, bound in leather. The writing was in ideographs, complicated in character. The hall on the opposite side was much the same but included what appeared to be public offices. In one part of the temple we found a garden of gold, such as Montezuma displayed to Cortes. Exquisitely formed flowers of gold, with insects and tiny birds of the same metal, flutteringly poised upon golden twigs, were set in gold dust soil. The golden effulgence and richness of the effect was beyond description. On another occasion we were privileged to attend one of the civic ceremonies in the great entrance hall. This was at a later period and there were some small changes to be noted. Now a gay crowd of chattering townsfolk was thronging the approaches or sauntering in the quiet gloom of the pillared hall. Temple servants in liveries of black with the insignia of the temple, a red cross worn on a white circle on the breast, marshaled the people into the great hall. All was done in order and dignity, for these burghers seemed to take their duties seriously. There was music of a sort to enliven the proceedings, but it was somewhat crude in character, being limited to a few conch horns, drums, cymbals and simple stringed instruments. Presently the conch horn sounded a fanfare and an air of expectancy stilled the assembly. A procession of priests and notables entered the hall from the central nave, wonderfully garbed in azure blue edged with silver, with the same insignia on their breasts, except that in this case the cross was of gold. Some priests wore a headdress of gold with a shining gem set in it. In the center of the procession came the king priest, more gorgeously apparelled than all the rest. Atlantis was still in a state of enlightenment and I could see that this was a great soul, sent on a divine mission. I will not attempt to describe the ceremonial for it was beyond my interpretation. There were presentations of petitions, delivery of decisions by the king, the promulgation of announcements and a number of speeches. Zeros reminded me that this was a theocracy, in which the king priest was held to be a channel of divine guidance, God ruling direct through man. A fact true in those days, though only its shadow has followed monarchy into modern times. At length justice was done, in seal of which the king drank ceremoniously from a goblet of chased silver, clustered with precious stones. Then the court withdrew to another fanfare and the crowd flowed out into the sunshine again, eagerly discussing what had transpired. It seemed to me that religion among these people of mixed race was general rather than particular. Worship of one god, usually through the medium of the sun or through temple ritual, seemed to form the background of their lives rather than a thing apart, as in later civilizations. Away from the capital, religion was a different matter. In the provinces, the Adamic influence was not so great, and with poor communications the white missionaries had difficulty in impressing the tribesmen in the more distant and sparsely populated regions, so that secret inhibitions held the people captive and prevented their spiritual development. Though they outwardly accepted the teachings and were absorbed in the psychic demonstrations they witnessed, they were hardly moved by them. It was in the soul that development was slow, for its awareness could only be cautiously awakened because of the occult knowledge that was latent there and which would undoubtedly be misused. So it was not easy to impress the villagers who would not leave their own villages. For them, natural manifestations of seismic or volcanic origin had far more powerful demanded propitiation of an exacting nature. Such was the profound difference between the two races at these early stages in the history of the continent. Yet the white race strove hard to fulfill their mission, and they accomplished much by force of example. The tribesmen would nod and chatter when they witnessed psychic demonstrations at the temples, but they would rather possess a reputed chip off one of the sacred statues in the Golden Temple than touch the hem of a white teacher's garment. In time, many of the dark-skinned people became educated and demanded entry to the priesthood, and thus became adepts in the use of the mysterious psychic powers. It was inevitable that their sorry inheritance must overshadow their natural desires, and soon the malignant influence of the dark forces in the lower astral realms sought to use this opportunity to extend smudging fingers of evil into this lovely land, until a growing number of junior priests had come under the subtle control of a force that was difficult to identify and which could not be stayed. If one surveys the tragic history of man right down to the present day, it is clear that the Atlantean civilization could not be expected to succeed. The cleansing of the fallen race was far too weighty a matter to be settled by the sweetening of one Augean's table. Divine prescience must have realized that many civilizations must rise and fall before this Herculean task could be accomplished. Yet because spirit is omnipotent and evil has no existence outside the free will of man, the end was certain and the experience imprisoned within the thraldom of time. The white Atlanteans were endowed with a genius for colonization. Quite early in their history study, streams of colonists went forth to far quarters of the globe, carrying to the indigenous inhabitants tales of these golden isles of the blessed, which survive in so many local legends in widely separated areas. Nearly all these stories have a common basis, of the arrival of large canoes or rafts, from which stepped white-skinned bearded men, wearing black robes with the insignia of the cross upon the circle. Always were they credited with psychic powers, and they spoke of a sun god who dwelt in a golden land, far beyond the spreading ocean. Meanwhile, the degeneration in the main continent increased as the centuries grew into millennia. Born of the two races, a new people came into being, proud, fearless, accomplished in the arts of war. Perversion began in the many sects that split theocracy into controversial elements. No longer were spirit teachers able to manifest in the temples, though a residue of their psychic powers remained and was used by the priests to extend their power over the people. In appearance, the new race, which I saw in later visits with Zeros, was not unlike the North American Indian, but with a more sloping forehead. But of course there were many strains in this biracial people, including the Negroid type. New gods were worshipped, and these talked to them of power, of conquest, and of all the things that make a man's heart swell with pride. And hints were thrown out of matters that could not be spoken of openly, but which were done in the dark recesses of the forest, bringing a maddening excitement all their own. The eyes of men glinted as they talked of mysterious doings in caves, the first hint of a soul-destroying sadism that was to eat away the heart of man. The blight was beginning to fall upon this splendid land and only needed receptive minds to make its slow eroding conquest. Thus began yet another fall of man, one that could not be prevented if man, as one whole conception of the Creator, was to purge itself of the incubus of sin and stand erect once more. Chapter 10, The Great Catastrophe. There are many stories extant concerning the end of the Atlantean civilization, but few of these record the truth, that the subsidence which marked its end had really been going on for thousands of years. Commencing as a vast continent, considerable portions broke away and were swallowed up by the encroaching ocean at such great intervals that the story of each disaster had become a myth by the time the next one occurred. In the end, all that was left was an island, and it was this island which, according to legend, disappeared in a day and a night. As the two races merged into one during the long history of the great continent, there came many changes in the characteristics and appearance of the resulting peoples, not one homogeneous race but many tribes differing in color and habits according to the predominance of the Adamic or indigenous influences. Over all there was a growing materialism, and most of these people were clever and cunning in battle, while they employed many strange weapons unknown to our armories. In general they were still handsome in appearance, but already showing signs of the flat faces and high receding foreheads of later known anthropology. Even the vegetation of the land changed during this period of hardening of the earth's crust and crystallization of its elements. The people were almost all flesh eaters by now, which added greatly to the coarsening of their bodies and their susceptibility to disease. Into their own nature they drew some of the animal nature through the flesh they consumed, together with animal fear and aggressiveness. Through heredity the resulting toxins were carried on in the bloodstream, causing accumulative degeneration of mental outlook and receptivity to spiritual influences. In this vitiated atmosphere the celestial visitors were unable to manifest. Instead the field lay open to entities whose intentions were the reverse of spiritual, for there was a residue of psychic power at the temples and monoliths where the spiritual teachers had been wont to instruct and lead the people. Excited and misled by what they took to be more powerful gods, many became maddened by lust, with a desire for conquest of any kind, including foreign wars and enslavement, for power of any kind. So it was that the influence of the cosmic Christ receded from the forefront of men's minds, though it still upheld and inspired the souls of those who would open their hearts to its benign influence. Faced with this rapid growth of degenerative influences, the priesthood, or at least that part of it which remained loyal, foresaw the need to conceal a powerful knowledge which they possessed but were unable to express. So it was enshrined in myth and symbol, over which we still puzzle to this day where it has been disclosed in ancient documents, abortively because we lack the key to understanding. Thus man was left to wear his coat of skin and labor with his hands, and to puzzle over the eternal problem of his plight, because he had shut himself off from the fountain of knowledge through his own self-will. But through it all the divine plan was at work, under the aegis of love. The flocculence of evil formed in the lower astral planes by the perverted thoughts of those who fell from high estate, had to be dissipated in the only way possible. Created and sustained by powerful but perverted mentalities, it could only be destroyed by releasing it through other mentalities, preferably in the limited circumscribed conditions of human existence. The whole history of Atlantis may be seen, not as a gigantic experiment that failed, but as a lengthy process in which the rebellious minds of men were used to release vast quantities of this evil miasma into manifestation, where it could be met and transmuted into its proper chemical constituents. We know so little about the world in which we live. Meanwhile, in this slow but steady retrogression, the lights began to go out all over Atlantis. Though many brave souls incarnated and through great labor and suffering strove to raise the flag of truth once more, their influence was ephemeral and could not have stayed the general decline. Yet never in its long history, even in its ghastly physical ending, did the everlasting arms fail to uphold the doomed continent, turning evil into good and sacrifice into spiritual power, giving and forgiving as always. The love that would not let them go. Zeros showed me how the solemn ritual of sacrifice, so wonderfully demonstrated in the Garden Beautiful, degenerated into loathsome imitation among the renegade priests. Instead of a simple offering to be immolated by atomic fire, There were offerings of value, to be taken for the benefit of the priests or the temples, having the effect of bribes. Then came animal sacrifices, where the letting of blood was found to release accretions of psychic power, up to the triumph of perversion wherein it became possible to create astral replicas of human or animal forms, possessing little short of concrete existence. These could be materialized and sent upon nefarious errands by their evil creators. I was not allowed to see any of these grisly creatures, nor did I wish to do so. Many will find it difficult to accept the veracity of this statement, for we admit of no such magic in our day, though rumors and tales abound. But these are not proof. We have to remember the considerable difference in the vibration of atomic matter between those days and our own times, when the crystallization of matter is complete. Added to which, the men of those days possessed a control over atomic forces which is lost to us. Only now are we coming to realize that it is not so much the crystallization of the actual atoms of matter as the coarsening of our senses and their relation to their environment. It was after one of the tremendous seismic disturbances that characterized life in those days, that a black emperor from one of the outer regions of what remained of Atlantis, no doubt deprived of his kingdom by subsidence, led his fear-maddened people on an invasion of the last stronghold of enlightenment, the city of the Golden Gates. Though the inhabitants of this city had become materialists to a degree, there was not the extent of degradation evident in the provinces. Vast hordes of black warriors, aided by fearful and uncanny weapons, with all the forces of illicit power behind them, overcame and enslaved the inhabitants of the city. But not even the arrogant power of the Black Emperor enabled him to establish his seat of government in the Golden Temple upon the hill. Some power beyond his ken held him back. So he built himself a palace within the city, and from there set up a regime of sadistic horror that could not bear the light of print. It was about this time that the priests were inspired to increase the streams of emigrants which for some centuries past had been establishing trade routes across the known world. Not merely one symbolic Noah set forth in an Arkansas, now were sent forth the last remaining loyal priests, that the teachings of this once marvelous civilization might not be lost to the world forever. Enshrined in the mysteries, known only to the initiates, was the knowledge of creative power over the elements and the subtle forces of the earth, to be preserved for future generations when man should once more be able to stand erect and pure in heart. There were four of these streams of refugees, moving along the prepared routes leading north, south, east and west from Atlantis, thus mystically symbolizing the sacred emblem, the cross within the circle of the earth, and giving rise to the legend that there were four rivers leading but of Eden. So was saved from the doomed continent all that was worth saving, dispersing and preserving a sure message of hope and faith that was to bear fruit upon another historic occasion. For it was this esoteric Christianity, with which the earth was impregnated at its birth, which enabled its more temporal manifestation in Palestine, when the cosmic Christ projected his universal being into a personality and made his immortal sacrifice. It was this esoteric Christianity which later spread like a hidden peat fire below the material minds of the people of that period, stirring the souls of men to a new understanding and setting on fire her hearts of people so ignorant that they could not possibly have comprehended abstractions which have caused controversy among theologians to this day. It was a soul fire rather than a mental one, owing some of its combustibility to those emigrating priests from Atlantis who set up spiritual centers in isolated parts of the world, lighting flame after flame from that which had burned so steadily in ancient to Atlantis. No matter what folly man commits, the cosmic Christ intervenes to smother the spreading fires of corruption, fighting them with the divine radiance in which all fires must fade. With God all things work together for good. Such was the lesson of Lemuria, of Atlantis, and repeated again and again through the checkered history of mankind. Meanwhile, the madness which had seized upon the Atlantean mind grew apace until the very atmosphere became redolent with evil emanation. Outwardly, the people remained a fine-looking, if cruel and rapacious race, making frequent aggressive expeditions to widen their territories to accommodate their growing population and serve their material needs. Great plunder and riches of slaves and merchandise came to the Golden City. And if the terrestrial upheavals, as prophesied by the astrologers, came with ever-increasing frequency and severity, what mattered it so long as the city survived and there was wine to drink and women to please the returning warriors? Were they not the greatest people in the world, with nothing to fear? Who could prevail against them? But as they turned further and further from the light, the fruits of knowledge became unripe to their lowered standard of morality. And so was established a vicious circle of poisoned minds begetting poisoned bodies, which in turn postulated poisoned minds again, and so the dark influence spread beyond control. A Frankenstein monster was created which devoured its creators. There is no need to dwell upon the frightful orgies and obscene festivals that marked the last days of Atlantis. We know from modern experience how whole nations can become enslaved by sadism and cruelty, though where modern tyrants tortured the victims' bodies they can rarely reach their souls. But the Atlantean leaders besmirched the very souls of their fellows, so much more open to infection because the human frame had not crystallized to the extent that contemporary human flesh has done. Thus it was that the whole civilization had to be removed from the earth in the greatest holocaust the world has known. In the island empire, the Golden Temple alone remained inviolate, though divine wisdom was no longer able to manifest there. The last of the initiate priests, their duty accomplished, awaited with calm the storm they knew must soon break. The final disappearance of this once lovely land was a terrible event. Zeros showed me glimpses of the seismic upheavals that preceded the final submergence. I witnessed the horror of the inhabitants as the evil flocculence which saturated the very soil was disinterred during those last ghastly moments, when inhuman phantoms fled in panic from jungle fastnesses. In that terrible breakup of dark astral forces, the physical and the lower astral planes of being met and clashed in one hideous moment of time. As volcano after volcano burst into violent eruption and belched forth suffocating flames and fumes, it seemed that the fetid breath of the lowest hells was sweeping forth to smother all in its path. Not all the inhabitants were evil. We read in myth and epic poem, some of which survived as our fairy tales and folklore, how valiant heroes, spiritually strong men, rescued fair maidens, pure hearts, from the clutches of noisome monsters, slaying giants of terrible habits. For the sake of the children, these terrible stories are very real, and to us, almost unbelievable tragedies of ancient to Atlantis, have been emasculated. But no tale, however horrific, could compete with the reality of that awful ending. Climb with me to the temporary safety of the Golden Temple, still serene in the sunshine. It is a still, peaceful day after the drenching rain of the past few months, which has left great lakes of flood water over the landscape. The citizens of the capital have emerged from their dwellings thankful for a dry day to get some of their clothing aired. There had been a series of earthquakes, more violent than usual, but people were accustomed to these and already gangs of slaves were at work repairing the damage. No one thought of further subsidence, for the last occasion was already but a dim memory. And such was their faith in the eternal quality of their city that they felt that nothing untoward could happen to it. So the warriors and merchants consoled themselves with banquets and the many sensual pleasures in which they delighted. It is sadly evident how this lovely city has altered since we first met it. Bristling battlements now enclose it and armed soldiers pace the streets, while the famous Golden Gates are closed at night. In dark pockets in the residential area, a vastly increased population overflows in regular rabbit warrens. Drunk with power and lust of conquest, these city dwellers wait for news of the great onslaught on the Mediterranean borderlands, which is to provide a jumping-off place for the final subjugation of the whole known world. They tarried over their feastings while the trash that were their slaves groaned under the lash. In the bazaars they chaffered and cheated, in their homes they dined and wined, in temples they sacrificed to the gods of wealth and power according to the fashion of the moment. and at times some slipped away into some ruined temple for heaven knows what bestial and sadistic rites. Night comes, and with it a sudden rise in temperature. Then a hot breathless morning greets the sun, while a deepening haze obscures the distant hills. The day grows more and more sultry and there are ominous rumblings and earth tremors. As dusk gathers and people emerge from their houses in search of cool air, there is a sudden crash and the storm bursts upon the doomed city. Great tongues of flame streak the darkening sky, and then with a roar and a thunderous crash the volcanoes add their hungry voices to the din. Even through the darkening haze of dust and rain and smoke the lurid streams of lava can be seen as the craters vomit their contents. The first reaction among the public is a sudden panic, to be followed, as they become accustomed to even these fierce manifestations, by a fatalistic resignation. With fearful glances over their shoulders they go about their normal tasks, with only a sense of irritability to show their inward fears. But the omens of disaster drew the people together as they realized that this was no ordinary occurrence. Master and slave, warrior and clerk, foregathered in a common sentiment and unity. As minor quakes shook down buildings here and there one could see how the soul of man shone forth. Amid scenes of growing horror there were examples of heroism, even to the extent of some proud warrior risking his life to save that of a miserable slave, such is the leveling effect of imminent danger. With nightfall an added horror was felt as huge boulders and other volcanic debris fell upon the stricken city, maiming and killing and setting buildings on fire. Aid was organized but even this faded as the situation got completely out of hand. Maddened with a fear that spread as quickly as the flames, people grew hysterical and rushed down to the quays and boarded the vessels there, regardless of the fact that the waterways were already choked with debris. The fury of the elements abated somewhat as dawn rose on the dreadful scene, with its pitiful evidence of carnage and destruction. Great areas of the city were already laid waste and a foul-smelling haze hung over it. The news from the city outposts, where there was any, was not encouraging. The calamity seemed to be nationwide and some coast towns were reported to be entirely submerged, with wholesale loss of life. As the sun climbed high into the heavens the diabolical manifestations began again and slowly mounted to a new crescendo of fury. Great balls of phosphorescent fire fell from the skies forcing the people to seek shelter, only to be driven forth again by fresh earth tremors. Out in the open they screamed as they beheld what the terrible skies disclosed. Men hurled themselves from roofs rather than face what was to come. And now, above the roar of the volcanoes and the eldritch screeching of the wind, could be heard a dull booming as mountainous tidal waves rose into the air and crashed down upon the distant beaches. Thousands of bodies of men and women and children were washed inland or sucked out to sea, as the waters piled themselves ashore in utter defiance of the forces of gravity. Soon they rushed inland and failed to retreat. Enormous areas of land were submerged and the very hills trembled as the weight of waters shook their foundations. Only the tremendous generators of volcanic eruption continued their fearful cacophony of sound, belching forth their boulders and balls of flaming lava which burst into livid streaks of fire. Most of the city was underwater when the end came. The lowest crater shuddered and sank into the greedy ocean which swept into the fiery cavern. There was a mighty roar as the two elements fought for mastery, but the end was certain. For though wave after wave was turned into terrific explosions, the weight of water gradually overcame the mighty fires with a smother of steam. One after another the mighty ones were subdued, each adding fresh convulsion to the shuddering earth. Scarcely a human being was left in sight. Finally the merciful elements drew a curtain over the last scenes of the slaying of a continent. As the last peaks sank into the boiling seas only an impenetrable mass of oceanic mud was left where this once glorious land had been. This viscous waste withstood or triary more bellying sail so that those who would have searched the site were unable to approach. Nothing was to be snatched from this land which had fallen under the mandate of the great law of love, manifesting through cause and effect. Thus nature performed her obsequies in decency and isolation. and a sentinel was placed at the gates of this one-time Eden also, so that the cleansing waters might wipe the stains of evil from the very atmosphere. Thus passed a great race, perhaps the greatest the world has ever known, in the greatest cataclysm in the world's sad record of wreck and ruin.